Lord Indra's been very kind. The rain has ceased. A little earlier we were glorifying the rainfall because it's very appropriate that there be a lot of rainfall during the time of Anukuta or Govardhana Puja. And of course it is lifted so we can all get out and feel safe on the beltway. Tonight we're celebrating a combination of two glorious events. One is Deepavali, which celebrates the return of Lord Rama to his kingdom of Ayodhya, and for Govardhana Puja. Govardhana Puja is significant, sometimes called Anukuta, at the time when Lord Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill. And this picture of Lord Krishna, or Nathadwara, is the posture of the Lord when he was holding up Govardhan Hill with his left hand and smiling for 7 days to shield the inhabitants, the residents of Raj, from torrential rainfall that lasted for 7 days. So that is one of the many miracles that we read about that occurred that many people find difficult to believe, but is one of the famous pastimes that the residents of Rajabhumi, Rajadham, Vrindavan still sing about today and still commemorate in many various ways. Govardhana Puja is also celebrated as a glorious feast, Anukuta, all over India, especially in Braj. And right next to Prabhupada's altar, back there, if you haven't noticed, I'm sure you have, there's a replica of Govardhan Hill, made of very wonderful cakes and swirls and sweet meats and gulab jamuns and rasgullas and many other delightful things, some cooked in ghee, some soaked in various types of sweet water, and it's been a very nice feast. So it's traditional that throughout our movement on this day that great replicas of Govardhan Hill are made. Some are actually more like mountains. This hill is sometimes referred to as a mountain. And devotees to this day circumambulate Govardhan. Govardhan Hill, or Giriraj, or sometimes it's known as Giridhari, is an actual manifestation of Krishna, or incarnation of Krishna. And it is worshipped, actually, as a very sacred thing. In fact, people don't take rocks and plants away from Govardhan, because it is sacred. So this hill, Giridhari, the bearer of the hill, Lord Krishna, or the hill of Govardhan, is a very sacred place to this day. You can see it. If you get on the Delhi-Agra road and you drive south east from Delhi, after about 2 or 3 hours you'll come to Vrindavan, and then you can be led to the glorious hill of Govardhan. Now, many devotees still circumambulate this hill, which is quite a big circumambulation. It's about 24 kilometers, about 16 or some odd miles like that. And to this day, some people walk around in a clockwise direction, this great deity of Krishna. Still, it's so sacred. And if you're very energetic, you can do it in 3 hours. If you're sprinting, you might do it in 2 hours. Sanatan Goswami used to encircle Govardhan Hill until he was very, very aged. And in his old age, the Lord, actually Krishna, appeared to him in his original form and said, "My dear Sanatan." Sanatan Goswami was a 16th century great pundit or scholar who wrote hundreds of thousands of Sanskrit verses and is a follower of Lord Chaitanya, who is glorified for diving very deeply into the Vedic literature and writing many wonderful books of knowledge, like Hari Bhakti Vilas and many others. So he actually had the darshan. He had a direct witness of Krishna, and Krishna appeared to him and said, "In your old age you're still circumambulating my incarnation of Govardhan, but I think you're getting very feeble. So I'm going to suggest that you just circumambulate this rock from the hill, and it will be as good as going around the hill itself, because this is a rock from Govardhan." So Krishna stood upon this rock with his famous stick that he sometimes rests his hand on and a calf, And this rock was so enthralled with Krishna's placing his lotus soles on it that it began to melt in ecstasy. And to this day, the footprints of Krishna and of this little calf are still visible on that stone. That stone is still to be seen in the altar of the Radha Damodar temple founded by Jiva Goswami in Vrindavan. And if you go there, you can see this wonderful, what is called Govardhan Shila, with Krishna's footprint in it, Lord Krishna's footprint as it appeared about 500 years ago. So this Diwali, we'll go back a little bit and talk about Deepawali Puja. This is sometimes known as the Festival of the Lights. It's the new year, according to the lunar calendar, the Hindu calendar. And you see the temple is at least behind you there. It's lit up with lights, and we're putting more and more lights. When Lord Ram came back from his banishment, he was banished for 14 years, along with Sita, his wife, and his brother Lakshman, and Hanuman, who took arms against the foe of Lord Ram. When he came back, he returned in a flower airplane to his city of Ayodhya. And when he came, it was very dark. It was at nighttime. And that was the night of the dark moon. When the moon is covered, there is no illumination, no natural illumination. But it was completely the dark moon, not a half moon, not a crescent moon, but a completely black moon, not a full moon. So for this reason, the entire city of Ayodhya was lit up very beautifully and very brightly by all the inhabitants. And therefore this celebration came to be called Diwali, or Deepawali. Deepa means light, or the festival of lights. And it's very glorious also that Lord Ram was the embodiment of the principles of religion. He was a Raja Rishi, or a ruler who ruled over the people in such a way that everyone wanted to be like him. Everyone admired him, everyone looked up to him, everyone felt protected by him. And the kingdom was free from even things like disease and pestilence and bad weather, all the sorts of things that we unfortunately have to experience here in the Washington area in the 20th century. This was a perfect, pure king who protected the citizens, who saw that they were all employed, that they were all engaged and very happily according to their guna and karma, according to their activity and their work. So this is a great victory for Lord Ram. It's not just a festival to celebrate putting up some lights, but it's the celebration of a kingdom, of a pious kingdom, a kingdom ruled by a saintly person. Of course, Lord Ramchandra is the incarnation of Krishna. He is Krishna himself. But he signifies and symbolizes a perfect ruler and a perfect kingdom, a kingdom in which everyone felt always happy and satisfied. Now, Govardhana Puja is a somewhat different pastime, the lifting of Govardhana Hill. And I'm going to highlight some of the things that Srila Prabhupada, the founder of our Hare Krishna movement, talked about when it was Govardhana Puja back in New York on November 4th, 1966. This was, 31 years ago. It's quite a while back. When Srila Prabhupada came to the West, he brought many of the traditions of the Vaishnava culture with him and implemented them. For example, the Ratha Yatra has now been taken up very seriously in over 80 cities all over the world, and it's reenacted in some places with as much pomp and ceremony as one experiences in its original place, which is in Puri, Jagannath Puri in Orissa, on the east coast, southeast coast of India. So this Govardhana Puja festival was brought by Srila Prabhupada, and replicas of this big hill made of sweets is a tradition that you'll see all over India, and this was brought to this country. And someday it will increase to the point where you'll walk into a temple like this and you'll see half the room will be filled up with a big mountain of cakes and sweets. In some temples it's almost like that. So it's getting to be a very big thing. And one of the principles of this Govardhana Puja festival and the purpose of building a big mountain of food offered to Krishna, spiritual food, is not just to have a big feast, but it signifies something. Signifies that the earth at the present moment supplies, or can supply anyway, enough food for everyone to eat. there are theories abounding that there's not enough food, and even 60 or 70 years ago or before that, there were economists like Veblen and Malthus who predicted that there wouldn't be enough food to go around, that the population would outstrip the food supply, and that by 1930, 1940, people would practically almost be falling off the planet. There would be so many. There wouldn't be enough food to eat, and people would be going hungry everywhere. But a little common sense shows us that most of the land in every part of the world, not just this country, is barren. It's not being cultivated. It's not being used. And most of the people are clustered into cities and city areas, urban areas like this, in like New York and Los Angeles or Bombay. Whereas there are huge tracts of land, millions and millions of miles of land that is lying fallow or not being used. Or if it is being used, very often it's being used for cash crops or for grapes or hops or things that are being used to manufacture, or tobacco, whiskey or liquor or cigarettes. These are very, very big primary sources of the gross national product of every country. And statistics show, and you can prove this by simple arithmetic, that if all the people in the whole world, every man, woman, and child, were clustered together somewhat, they could all fit inside the state of Texas and have 1,000 square feet of living space. And that's how much room there is. And according also to statistics, and this has been proven by several agencies that aren't spiritual or religiously oriented at all, that there is enough food now being produced to feed 10 times the population of the earth. And if all of the land were properly utilized for growing food that people could eat rather than tobacco and hops and barley and malt and things that are used for whiskey and wine and cigarettes, and people were not hooked on eating a flesh-centered diet, that Earth could feed 40 times what it's feeding now. 40 times. So these are statistical data that have been proven, that have been shown to be real. So part of this Govardhana Puja Festival, in building a big mountain of food, is to show that there is enough for everybody. And even a little bit of charity, if everyone, for example, gave 5 or even less percent of their income, and there were an agency that could equally distribute all of the food, then there would be no question of hunger or malnutrition in the world. It would be spread around evenly. So these are some of the statistics that show that due to greed, people are taking undue advantage. So people of power and wealth are taking undue advantage of the rest of the world. So these are some of the hard facts of life. And just to give you another idea, that wealth also is unevenly distributed. Of course, we can put that down to karma and so on, but it is also due to exploitation, at least half. So we can consider the whole world, there's a certain amount of wealth, or you could say, well, real wealth, as we'll hear about what Prabhupada said, is really to be measured in land and cows and grains. But just in terms of dollars, if all of the wealth in the world were evenly spread, evenly divided among each person, out of, say, some 6 billion or odd, some odd people that are now supposed to inhabit the earth, what would someone guess would be the amount each person would have? Equally, all the money in terms of dollars, all the wealth, were evenly divvied out to each man, woman, and child out of 6 billion people. What would be the average each person would have? Anyone want to guess? Come on, did I know there's an economist in the crowd? 1 billion? Yeah, what do you say? 1 million? Yes? Gregory, you're an economist, what do you say? 200. Well, we did have a correct answer, and that's $1 million. So that's a lot, actually. And in terms of food, same thing applies. And it could apply even more if more food for consumption were grown. So when this 5,000 years ago in Vrindavan, when this Anukuta or Govardhana Puja Festival took place, there was a sacrifice being prepared by Nanda Maharaj, Krishna's foster father, was a big sacrifice to Lord Indra. Lord Indra, or Mahendra, is the controller of the rains. Sometimes we've read in what we call Hare Krishna, sometimes we read about the Greek pantheon, or we hear about Greek mythology, we call it, and the different gods of the forest, the gods of breath, the gods of the air, the gods of this and that. And this actually comes from Vedic literature, that there are demigods. There are 330 million, actually, which supply different things like light and heat. And Indra is the controller of the rains and the clouds. So this sacrifice is being prepared by Nanda Maharaj to appease Indra. Not to appease, but to, I suppose appease is the right word, but as a tribute to Indra, so that there would be plenty of rainfall. Because Nanda Maharaj was born in a Vaishya agricultural family, and they depended upon rain so that the grains and crops would all grow properly. So he was preparing a big sacrifice. And then we read about this in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is extensively written about. It covers nearly four chapters. So in this time, Krishna, of course, appeared, and he appeared in his original form, something that is a very rare occurrence on this earth. And not many people understood who exactly he was. Only a few hundred, Prabhupada was saying in this lecture, understood that he was actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But they knew he was not an ordinary child. At the time of this Govardhana Puja, he was about 6 years old. So they thought he was some empowered being, like some great demigod, or someone who was given, a great yogi, someone who was given mystic power. So he was beginning to approach his father and arguing that maybe, just maybe this time, this year, we shouldn't have such a sacrifice for Indra. And he began to put forward various philosophies, such as the Karma Mimamsa philosophy, which says that you can get, according to karma, you'll get a definite result, a definite return. It's just like we know if we put, say, $100,000 in a certificate of deposit, we'll get a certain amount back every $300 or $400 or something like that every month. So according to Karma Mimamsa, if we engage in a particular activity, we'll automatically, guaranteed, get a certain return. So one of the arguments Krishna, as a six-year-old, presented to his foster father, Nanda, is that if we just carry on and do good work and grow good crops, then automatically we'll get all the rainfall, we'll get all the fertility, and we'll have good crops. Our treasures, our coffers will be full, we'll be successful. Now we don't have to make such a big, elaborate sacrifice. So this is one of the unique characteristics of Krishna. He is God himself, and yet he's giving the idea, presenting the idea that the karma can act independently of God, that it has its own sort of momentum, and that one needn't undergo the process of worshipping. So this is one of the philosophies he presented. One of the things that this brings up is that Krishna, the Supreme Person, is the fountainhead of all philosophies and all knowledge. And one of these forms of knowledge that we encounter, especially these days, is the philosophy of atheism, that there is no God. So he began to get into that philosophy a bit. And it's also a philosophy here, it's an atheistic philosophy, that if we do a certain thing, we'll get a certain effect. It's kind of a law of cause and effect. If we put petroleum, gasoline in a car, the car will start. And if we work very hard, we will get money. And if we want to be successful and we work very hard, we will get success. So these things are mentioned in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So he asked his father to disclose the real meaning of his sacrifice. And his father was very keen to tell him, because he addressed him as a sadhu. And a sadhu, according to Vedic literature, is one who has no private life, that the private life and public life are really the same. So he's very honest, in other words. So he approached him, and his father began to explain that we depend on this rainfall, and we depend on Indra's good graces, and in order every year for us to have proper crops and proper rainfall, we will worship him. Otherwise, we won't succeed. So Krishna began to mildly, not rebuke him, but question him in such a way that he was challenging him. He said that people often perform religious rituals out of superstition. They don't know what they're doing, or they don't even get a result. They just do it. And this is called superstition. So in other words, there's a Vedic saying that what is the use of performing any kind of function if there's not a result of that function? What is the meaning of it? There was a big discussion between Lord Chaitanya and a Mohammedan Qazi about certain types of sacrifices that were mentioned in the Vedas, and what is the result of those sacrifices. And if there's a result, then one should practice them. So the question here was, would there be a result? If we're going to get rainfall anyway by doing the activity we do, why should we perform a big sacrifice? So then he went on to say that, well, maybe there is no God. This is God himself saying that, showing that he's the source of all philosophies. So if there is a God, he's going to be pacified. And if there's not a God, still we're going to get the results of our activity. So if you're doing this out of some idea of worshiping God or a God like Indra, it's also not going to get any effect, because we're going to get the result anyway. The result is going to come. That's just obvious. Otherwise it's just superstitious. So he presented this philosophy. And his father, I'm going to quote from Prabhupada here. He says, "My dear boy, we should not give up this parampara." Parampara means system, a succession. He said, "My father did it, my father's father did it, and so on." And this is called, in one way of defining it, this is called dharma. Dharma means to do the duty that we have to do according to the duty that's been done by our forefathers. The dharma is also defined as that thing which is the unchanging element of all things, the thing which does not change. The dharma of water is liquidity, for example. The dharma of ice is coldness. So Krishna tried to convince Nanda Maharaj not to stick to some form of dharma that was just superstitious, but dharma that should be eternal, dharma that should get a result based on its eternality. So gradually and through various arguments, he appealed to his father that we are mercantile people, we shouldn't be superstitious, our duty is to protect the cows. This is stated in Bhagavad Gita, Krishi Goraksha, Anijam, Vaishya. This duty of a Vaishya is to protect cows, is to engage in agriculture. We do our duty, we don't have to be superstitious, we don't have to worship God to get the result. Prabhupada once talked about how he was taking his magazine called Back to Godhead to the post office. And the chief postal clerk said, "I've been seeing you come here time after time, month after month, with your magazine Back to Godhead. And I've just been thinking, why do you have to call it Back to Godhead? Your articles talk about being good and honest and obedient and respectful and responsible. And you can be all those things. You don't have to worship God to be all those things." So Prabhupada's rejoinder to that, he said, was that my point is, if you don't have God, you cannot be moral, honest, obedient, loyal, faithful, and responsible and moral. And he went on to explain how God, or Krishna in this case, is the fountainhead of all things which are moral, good, obedient, and in the mode of goodness. So this is what Krishna was actually tricking his father, Nanda Maharaj, into doing. Because at one point, he incarnated as the very hill of Govardhan itself, and he told his father, "If you have to worship something, just worship the hill, because it is from the hill that you get all wonderful grasses, all herbs, all medicines, all the growth, all the rainfall, everything that's verdant and beautiful and productive and necessary for our existence comes from the hill. So if you have to worship something, worship the hill." Well, Krishna was that hill. So just as in his incarnations, his various incarnations of Lord Buddha and so on, he was tricking the people, so to speak, to worship him as Lord Buddha or as Govardhan. He was doing this with his own father, to say that if you worship this hill, that is, if you have to worship something, just worship the hill. Anyway, he finally convinced Nanda Maharaj not to do the sacrifice, this very elaborate sacrifice. It's very expensive, it requires Brahmins, it requires a lot of money, it requires a lot of goods, and he finally convinced him. So Lord Indra became a bit annoyed at this, and as sometimes happens in the higher planetary systems, even the great demigods, they don't understand who Krishna is, that he's the all-powerful supreme person. And when he specially incarnates as a young child, as a human being, and goes through the stages of life in which he's a young child of 6 or 7, they sometimes forget that it's actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And even beings like Lord Brahma sometimes forget that Lord Brahma has a leela in which he tries to trick Krishna. So Lord Indra became very annoyed at this, that this young cowherd boy has convinced Nanda Maharaj not to engage in the service of myself and doing this wonderful big sacrifice. So he became annoyed, and through his mystic power, he brought torrents of rain. He brought great clouds of rainfall, and it rained incessantly. So much so, non-stop, big drops of rain, that there was flooding all over the Vrindavan area, all over the Braj area. And as great lovers of Krishna, all of the inhabitants of Braj, they felt very helpless, that they would be drowned in this downpour, in this deluge. So they begged Krishna, please somehow save us. And to this day, most of the residents of Vrindavan, of Raj, they feel very dependent on Krishna. They're always looking to Krishna. They're always singing about Krishna. They're always thinking about and worshipping and offering to Krishna. So they naturally approached him and said, please do something to protect us. So it was at this juncture that Krishna manifested his mystic power and became the great personality we sing about, Sairadha Madhava Kunjabihari Gopi Jana Balaba Giri Dharadhari. Giri Dharadhari, Dhari means the holder, and Giri means the hill. So Krishna is constantly glorified in that song as the holder, the bearer of Govardhan Hill. So he actually lifted this hill, which is impossible for an ordinary person to do because of the weight. And it's also impossible for a hill like Govardhan, which is composed mainly of rock, to stay together in a cohesive unit, which it did when Krishna lifted it up. It stayed together, he held it up, and he held it on one finger. And he was smiling the whole time. And this way he protected the inhabitants of Raj from drowning from this great deluge. And for 7 days he stood like this, smiling very happily, and conversing with his family and his friends. And this is the Giridhari who we honor today and celebrate as the great lifter of Govardhan Hill, Lord Giridhari. There are many pictures in our books of this pastime, and in Vrindavan people take this as a fact. It's not just a story or a myth, but this great festival is celebrated in commemoration of Krishna's lifting the Govardhan Hill. And at the end of the great rainfall, there was a big feast, which we're going to celebrate today. So that's the story of Govardhana Puja. Now, at this time, we'd like all of you, and I know you all like doing this, to engage in some meditation with all of us. This is our group meditation, as it were. We're going to chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra together. Lakshman will hand out beads to all of you. These are 108 beads, and the meditation for the age of Kali is to chant on these beads regularly every day. So we do this, and for those of us who are initiated, we have a vow to chant a certain amount every day. We chant 16 rounds of japa every day, and if you chant even one round or half a round or two or three or four, it's also very beneficial. So the method is to begin on this bead with these two fingers, and then we chant around the whole row of beads. Is Lakshman here with our beads? I saw him. Oh, okay, very good. It's pretty hard to chant without beads. and we'll chant one round together, and that's the mantra. Is anybody here first time? For your very first time? This lady and this lady. Anybody else? Big turnout. And in the back? Okay. I think we used up all of our gifts for first timers already. So just enjoying. We'll have a very nice feast for all of you. So So we hold the beads like this with the thumb and the third finger. And for those of you who are new, the mantra is right up there on the wall, above the alcove, above the doorway to this temple store. And by the way, if you haven't been to our temple store, or even if you have been, it's always being stocked and restocked. One of our devotees just returned from India. You'll find many wonderful things like these beads, yukurtas, and many nice books, deities, incense, and tapes and CDs. So please visit this temple shop or store after the aarti. So we'll chant together for about 10 minutes. We hold the bead like this, the summit bead, the bead next to the one with the tassel on it, and then we go around the whole set of beads chanting one mantra on each bead. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.